The viewpoints expressed in the following program are not necessarily those of WRUU, its license holder, or its staff. The following program contains subject matter and realistic language that some listeners may find objectionable. Listener discretion is advised. Well, good afternoon, Savannah. It is just past 12 o'clock on this Friday, and that means you're now listening to literature with Lee and PT. Now, here at Listening to Literature, PT and I like to, examine thought-provoking books of the present and the past. And if you want to check out some of our prior shows, you can always go to WRUU.org or listeningtoliterature.com. Now, PT, who do we have on tap for today?
Oh, well, we have a subject that people have written great long books on, and we're not going to do that, but we're going to examine some of the plays and thoughts of George Bernard Shaw.
Yes, absolutely. GBS. And actually, let's start with his name, because he didn't really like his first name, and in fact, he really wanted people to know him as Bernard Shaw.
He did.
Right. But interestingly enough, he had a tendency to sometimes engage what he kind of called his alter ego or this other persona where he used his initials GBS. And sometimes he actually signed some letters and some things G. Bernard Shaw. And so many books that you will find even published today have all three names. I'm not sure that would make him very happy.
Well, it was always very difficult to figure out what would make him happy.
that is an understatement.
And I wonder what he would have thought the first time somebody called him Bernie.
Right, which is probably how we would know him in the modern day and age. I do have a quote here from a book about, and it is called George Bernard Shaw. It's written by Hill. Let me give you Hill's first name here. Eldon C. Hill, out of Miami University. It's a 1978, so we're going back a little ways. But this is just the opening paragraph. The first problem that confronts anyone who writes of Shaw is that of his dual identity. Bernard Shaw and GBS, his familiar alter ego or persona. Shaw once wrote, quote, "The celebrated GBS is about as real as a pantomime ostrich." Again, when asked to state his honest opinion of GBS, Shaw replied, and this is a quote from him again, "Oh, one of the most successful of my fictions, but getting a bit tiresome, I should think. GBS bores me, except when he is saying something that needs saying and can be best be said in the GBS manner. GBS is a humbug."
Yep. And I think that's the first clue to some of the things that he wrote and said. And that is that I think sometimes he was doing a little bit of an act.
And absolutely. And it also, you can get a sense even just from those quotes, a sense of his wit. And it's sort of an ironic wit or a cynical wit sometimes.
Right.
A very sharp wit.
Very, very much so. And some of his observations, humorous or otherwise, show those same characteristics.
Absolutely. And some of the background I was reading on Shaw says that some of this might have actually come a bit from his father. Now, he didn't necessarily have, I think, a great relationship with his father. He was born in Dublin. There's even some quotes I've read from him where he wasn't really all that happy as a child in Dublin, I think, especially when his father and he stayed behind and his mother and his sisters went to London.
Right.
Some of his wit and cynicism might actually come from his father. Now, his father had a bit of a drinking problem.
Right. And there are all sorts of problems that arise from that particular problem, and it's easy to see where that might create some frostiness.
Right, and I have another quote, again from that Hill book by Shaw, commenting on, this is Hill's words, "the sadness of his father's weakness," but here he is quoting Shaw himself. "If you cannot get rid of the family skeleton, you may as well make it dance." So,
yes.
Yeah, again, this is the same kind of wit you see in many of his plays and his other writing. He actually I mean, he was prolific in terms of the amount of plays he produced over the course of his lifetime. But he didn't write just plays, did he, P.J.?
Oh, heavens no. There's poetry. There are some novels. At one point in his life, he got very interested in Fabian socialism, and he wrote extensively about that. And forgive me for saying so, but he was rather shrill when it came to that sort of thing.
He has a couple of nonfiction texts as well. One of the
Absolutely.
Things he called for, probably which aligned with his socialism, he very early on, he called for an 8-hour workday, which was, you know, pretty outrageous and scandalous at the time.
And I think that's another thing about Shaw, and this may also have come from the time when he was living with his father, is he became very withdrawn and very analytical about any situation, almost as if he was floating above the situation, whether he was in it or not. And some of his opinions, quite frankly, are erroneous, shall we say.
Yes.
And I think a lot of that is due to the fact that he was looking at things from an analytical view rather than a participant view.
Right. And we'll probably later in our discussion get into some of those, especially with our present day eyes, erroneous ideas.
Absolutely.
He had.
Absolutely.
It's interesting how you phrased it, P.T. You were talking about how he was sort of floating above things
right.
sort of analyzing things at a distance. When thinking about his earlier life in Dublin, he wrote later in his life, when ghosts rise up from that period, I want to lay them again with a poker. So you can really get that, not only get that sense of his unhappiness early on, but also, like you said, that distance he might have from some of his experiences.
Oh, absolutely. And I think whether he was analytical or not, especially in his nonfiction writings, some of those ghosts come back and make themselves known, at least in his plays.
Oh, absolutely. And before we get to his plays, I know you and I, we want to focus on maybe a couple of his plays today. We can't cover all of GBS or Bernard Shaw, however you want to look at him, in one episode. Let's talk a little bit about, but before we get to his plays, right?
Okay.
So he ended up quitting school around the age of 15 and a half.
He every time he was asked, he said he loathed the schools that he was in. He didn't have much use for formal education. He did not have much use for some of the things that formal education supported, such as religion,
right,
or the social order, or and his whole life seemed to be a rebellion against that almost.
Yes, and while he didn't have put much stock in formal education, he was so well self-educated.
He was, and that is the difference, because he would take ideas from all over and put them together in completely unexpected ways and come up with viewpoints that would drive people crazy, because it was obvious where his sources were, but he used them in entirely different ways than they would have been used in somebody who was formally educated.
Absolutely. Now, when he was still in Dublin, when he was about 15 and a half or so, he did work as a clerk for a real estate company. And then eventually he decided to move to London, where his mother and his sisters were. And when he first got there, he took up a job with a London firm that sold and installed Edison telephones.
And I think that's significant too, because he was caught up in the great gizmo phase of that time. Radios, bicycles,
automobiles. Yeah.
Especially automobiles.
Yeah, so he actually put an automobile on the stage of one of his plays in the early
right.
1900s. I found this interesting. So, and while he was working as for this firm in London, he also started writing novels, because he knew he did not want to stay in this particular even type of job. He started writing novels, and I had to giggle. when he was talking about how he wrote these original novels, he wrote five novels. They weren't necessarily well received. He had a very hard time even getting them published. But he said when he wrote these novels, he was still very much in his clerk mindset. And he wrote five large pages a day, quote, rain or shine, dull or inspired. I had so much of the schoolboy and the clerk still in me that if my five pages ended in the middle of a sentence, I didn't finish it until the next day. On this plan, I produced five novels in 5 years. The manuscripts were sent to all the publishers in London and some in America and were uniformly rejected. Now, this might be the story of many, many a great author, of having your original works or your original drafts rejected.
Well, it's the story of 99% of them.
That's right. But this really didn't daunt him. So here he is. He says again, I never had anything accepted. But if I had never written the five long novels and the bushel of articles that were refused, I should not have been able to do the work that finally offered itself to me. You must keep on knocking your head against the stone wall until it gives way. Only remember the saying, knock and it shall be opened unto you. There's no use in waiting if you don't knock.
Right.
And boy, did that door open.
Oh, did it ever. And curious, this is kind of curious too. If you read his plays, the stage directions are lengthy. He writes his plays almost as if they were novels.
Yes.
And the audience never sees a lot of it, but it gives the actors and the set designers and so forth a very clear idea of what he's trying to portray.
Absolutely. I sit and I sometimes wonder these days if directors and actors and set designers aren't a little peeved about his lengthy descriptions and lengthy directions in his actual printed work. Simply because, you know, this is a collaborative process. And I think,
It is, yeah. But I think they also feel comfortable ignoring them. Actually, it's the actors, I think, who benefit most because he gives an idea of where his characters are coming from.
Because in those directions, it's not just here's how the place or the setting looks and here's you know how the character moves or interacts with, you know, a one character to the next. It's actually some insights into the internal life of the characters, what the character is thinking. Let me see if I can find,
While you're doing that, Lee, one of his characters in a play that we'll cover, Man and Superman, has written a guide to advanced thinking, if you will, and it makes reference to it during the play. Shaw actually wrote the guide and appended it to the play, and it runs about 50 pages. I mean, that's taking creativity to quite some depth.
Right. And that publication, Man of Superman, it starts actually with a letter to a critic who had suggested that at some point in time that Shaw write a Don Juan play, and there's a very, very, very lengthy letter. And so the funny thing is some people have joked that Man and Superman is a text in which you happen to find a play. And at the copy that I have here is over 300 pages, and they're pretty dense pages. And I think that those critics are right. But PT, here's an example of some of the stage directions and introduction that Shaw has in Man and Superman. I'll give you just a few quotes. It's a huge, long paragraphs from Act One of Man and Superman. Roebuck Ramsden is in his study opening the morning letters. The study, handsomely and solidly furnished, proclaims the man of means. Not a speck of dust is visible. It is clear that there are at least two housemaids and a parlor maid downstairs, and a housekeeper upstairs who does not let them spare elbow grease. Even the top of Roebuck's head is polished. On a sunshiny day, he could heliograph his orders to distant camps by merely nodding. And then a little bit further down, and again, this is paragraphs down, Shaw is still, this is still the opening of Act One in the stage directions. How old is Roebuck? The question is important on the threshold of a drama of ideas. For under such circumstances, everything depends on whether his adolescence belonged to the 60s or to the 80s. He was born, as a matter of fact, in 1839, and he was a Unitarian and free trader from his boyhood, and an evolutionist from the publication of The Origin of Species. Consequently, he has always classed himself as an advanced thinker and fearlessly outspoken reformer.
And that sets his character so well for how he acts in the play.
Absolutely.
And he's used to thinking of himself as quite an advanced thinker and keeps on running into situations where his thinking isn't all that
maybe
advanced.
Not so. And the some of the parts I skipped over talk about even, you know, he has four tufts of, you know, graying hair coming out of his head. I mean, Shaw is very, very specific. And I don't know if this is because he started out with writing those novels. You know, I know he also, you know, he was very involved, I think, in many of the productions of his plays.
Something else that occurred to me, Lee, the occasions for seeing a play were not great in his era. Mm. And he may have had an eye on the reading audience as well as the attending the performance audience.
Right, absolutely. So that you can enjoy his works, and through his works, of course, his philosophies and his ideas, whether you're seeing it through actors on the stage or through the printed words on a page. I think you're right. I think he probably had that kind of foresight, because he wanted his ideas heard and discussed, and
I mean, oh boy, did he ever!
He was a man of ideas. So anyway, so
very much.
So how do you know? How does he become, you know, a playwright after basically being a quote unquote failed novelist? Well, he starts spending many of his days in the reading room at the British Museum.
He does, but I think the idea was already planted as a child. He had come to know many actors and people involved in the theater because one of the elders in his house was involved with that. Mm-hmm. And I think it had already certain fascination for him.
Right. So his mother was a singer, and she performed as a singer. She also gave lessons as a singer. She becomes very, very good friends with John Lee.
Lee.
Right. And this is one of the many reasons why she goes to London. With her husband basically being struggling with alcoholism and sort of not really bringing home the bread, the mother is sort of keeping the household afloat. And so you're right. And so especially I think when Shaw ends up going to London, he's living with his mother and his sisters. And yeah, I think he would be in the thick of things. He also, when he's at the British Museum, he meets a friend of his, becomes a friend of his, William Archer, who is, you know, writing for the newspapers as a drama, I believe a drama critic. Shaw knew music inside and out. Through self-education, he knew art inside and out. He started to know plays inside and out. And so I believe it's Archer who gets Shaw working for newspapers as a critic.
And by that time, he had enough knowledge to become a critic, yes.
Absolutely. And then they also decide, you know, hey, you know what would be great? Let's collaborate on a play together. And there are different perspectives of this story from the two men, and even different perspectives of the story from the same man, you know, so you have to dig through to see which one you think is true. But yes. Apparently Archer and Shaw said, well, look, you know, Shaw really does not know how to write the well-constructed plot, and Archer does, and Shaw knows how to write great dialogue, and Archer does not, and so they decided to collaborate. Shaw later, I think, tells a story of about how, you know, he takes Archer's initial plot, and he's starting to write this play, and then he comes back to Archer, but, you know, by the third act, he's like, oh, I've already run out of your plot, I need more. But again, you've got to go back through all the history and the debate between the two men to see what was really factual and what wasn't. But it seems like it was a fruitful friendship on at least on several fronts. Obviously, they did not continue their collaboration. Shaw went off and produced many, 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 many plays on his own.
And there's an immense amount of personal growth at this time as well. He becomes a vegetarian.
Yes.
He meets Sidney Webb and gets an interest in Fabian socialism. he was actually subsidized at this time by his mother. And so there's now some pressure on him to make money with his writing.
Right, because his mother didn't necessarily need another mouth to feed.
She did not.
Right. But I do wonder, you know, in his mother, if that's, you know, if we're seeing the inklings of some of his female characters, which I know we'll talk about a little bit later,
sure.
P.T., you know, she... you know, she seems to embody quite a bit of the new woman, whether she, you know, sought that out or not.
I think his response would be that the new woman isn't really new at all. It's
right.
just that she's finally being seen for what she does.
For what she does, absolutely, absolutely. You know, and much many of his plays are about sort of the new man and the new woman. And as you say, P.T., I don't know if he sees that there's necessarily much difference between them. He's really interested in how we as human beings can progress, particularly through our minds, knowledge-wise, intellectually.
He's absolutely interested in that. But he's also keenly aware of the difference between the progress that matters and the progress that
doesn't. So,
and it's his male characters that suffer from that much more than his female.
I think you're absolutely right. One of the books I was reading about him this past week talked about, you know, one night he decided to walk across London. And in his walk across London, you know, it really opened his eyes to see the levels of poverty that were in the city. And this, of course, you were talking about his evolution politically. This goes along with it, because I think he starts to think, you know, how can human beings, he would say man, but how can human beings be so intelligent and, you know, and so capable of that analytical reasoning you were talking about earlier? And you know, and fight for developing weaponry and so forth, and yet letting our population live in squalor and starve, that really affected him.
It did. And he developed not only an interest in Fabian socialism, but he became interested enough to start wondering if there wasn't a more political way to apply that. It's all very well to talk about socialism in a middle class London context, but can actually be done? And he, like many people in that era, became fascinated with the Soviet Union as one possible way where that could happen.
Right, and he was sort of a revolutionary in his own way, but he wanted to be a nonviolent revolutionary.
He did. One of the things that's always incredible to me is the number and the complete job that the Soviet Union did on Western intellectuals who went there. They were shown all sorts of things that we know now are simply not true.
Right.
They put their best foot forward with a considerable stomp. A lot of people were taken in by that. Shaw made one of these trips and was taken in by that. And he always... even when it was obvious that Stalin perhaps wasn't the genial person that
right.
he pretended to be at sometimes, Shaw still saw value that nobody else saw in what was happening
right.
there. And to me, that's just a little myopia on Shaw's part.
Right. He did. We know he did read. He read many, many things, but he did read Marx's Das Kapital. And one of his characters in Man and Superman, in those lengthy stage directions, I'm sorry. In Candida, actually, in Candida, one of his main characters, the Reverend, in the opening description of what the Reverend's study looks like. It on his bookshelf is a copy of Marx's Capital. You know, PT, we're just about at the half-hour mark here. So you had mentioned that Shaw was a vegetarian, let me give our listeners just a little quote, not from Shaw, but from H.G. Wells, and then we'll go for a brief break for station identification and a few announcements. So this is from one of Shaw's private secretaries. The story comes from her, Miss Blanche Patch. And she said sometime before her death that H.G. Wells had once remarked to Shaw after seeing one of his plays that Shaw could not control his wit and love of larking, urging him to, quote, dull himself with meat, and then he would be a great dramatist. A gratuitous piece of advice which Shaw, a strict vegetarian all his life, no doubt duly appreciated. And on that note, let's take a brief break.
This is WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings Community Radio with Global Soul. This portion of WRUU-LP, Savannah Soundings programming, is brought to you by listeners and by the Savannah Jazz Festival, which brings jazz and blues to Forsyth Park and other locations around Savannah from September 22nd to the 28th. The Savannah Jazz Festival is presented by the Coastal Jazz Association with investment from the City of Savannah. Evening concerts followed by nightly jam sessions bring artists such as Dolette McDonald, The Huntertones, Big Sam's Funky Nation, Vanessa Rubin, and Annette Cohen to Savannah. For more information, go to savannahjazzfest.com.
WRUU's summer auction is now underway with some great deals. The online auction continues through September 13th. At WRUU.org, find the auction link to music, museum, and theater tickets, gift certificates for books, art, coffee, eateries, and more, all locally sourced. Indulge yourself or a friend. What do you want to bid on? All proceeds support this nonprofit radio station, Savannah's best radio station in the 2019 Connect Savannah Best of Poll. Look for summer auction at WRUU.org.
Tonight on WRUU, tune in at 7 for Feel the Darkness, Underground, Punk, and Hardcore. At 8, Let's See Who My Friends Are interviews ordinary people sharing their stories. At 9, Soul Sensations features R&B through the decades. At 10, the Savannah Music Festival Live brings you music recorded at the Savannah Music Festival. And at 11, we bring you 2 hours of Friday night dance music. Our latest schedule is always at WRUU.org. Thanks for listening.
Well, welcome back to Listening to Literature here on WRUU 107.5 FM. Today, PT and I are talking about George Bernard Shaw, or just Bernard Shaw. I think he would prefer it that way. So, PT, right before the break, I shared that quote from H.G. Wells, who basically intimated that Shaw was not a great dramatist because he had too much wit and too much larking. I think history might disagree with Wells.
I think what Wells really was saying is he probably could have written another 50 plays if he had been serious, but serious wasn't really part of his character at that point.
Right, right. And interestingly enough, again, his last secretary, Shaw's last secretary, Blanche Patch, has been quoted that Shaw himself was kind of, I don't know if he was poking fun at himself or maybe agreeing a little bit with Wells. She says, I remember hearing GBS telling some students at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art that he sometimes felt he had achieved the heights of literary fame and said to himself, quote, I am there. I am at the top. And then Joey the Clown pops out between my legs and I can never resist him.
Yeah, and this kind of gets into what I was talking about before. You have this GBS character, which I think incorporates some of Joey the Clown.
I think so.
And then you have the real Shaw, and they were very different.
Very different.
And you never quite know who you're dealing with at any point.
But I think the mix of the two is what makes his plays so witty and poignant. You know, comedic and philosophical at the same time. We started talking about Man and Superman, which is more sort of, you know, book or treatise than play, right, in a certain sense. And he actually subtitles it a comedy and a philosophy.
He does. And perhaps that accounts for the lengthy introduction and the lengthy postscript.
Absolutely.
And every all of those pages and pages of stage direction that go in it.
Right.
It's interesting, nowadays people just find it too much to deal with. Sometimes people will play just act three alone, which
right,
is the philosophical part.
Right.
Sometimes they'll play everything else without
act three. I was reading one book that said, look, in order to do this entire play the way that he would want it done, it would take about 8 hours, and act two alone would take 2 hours. And maybe what our listeners who don't know Man and Superman, on the one hand, it seems like, I don't want to say conventional, but almost a conventional comedy, Shakespearean type of comedy, where you have a set of potential lovers as the main plot, and then a subplot with another set of potential lovers. So very Shakespearean in a certain way. But then Act Three comes around, and Act Three is actually this Don Juan philosophical play within this larger play.
Right. All the characters retain some of their characteristics, but instead of talking about their real life situation, they're talking about abstractions.
Yes.
And I love the one comment the character who plays the devil pops up as the devil in Act Three, and Shaw's comment is he's all Mephistophelian, but he's not quite as interesting as the actual character
right,
was before.
Right.
And that's, you know, to be more interesting than the devil takes a bit.
It does take a bit. And so the beginning of Man and Superman, at least in written form, Shaw begins with an epistle dedicatory to Arthur Bingham Walkley, who was a critic. And I'll just give our listeners the first paragraph of this very, very, very lengthy letter. You can read it on your own if you would like. Shaw writes, "My dear Walkley, you once asked me why I did not write a Don Juan play. The levity with which you assume this frightful responsibility has probably by this time enabled you to forget it. But the day of reckoning has arrived. Here is your play. I say your play because qui facit per alium facit per se. Its profits, like its labors, belong to me. Its morals, its manners, its philosophy, its influence on the young are for you to justify. You were of mature age when you made the suggestion, and you knew your man. It is hardly 15 years since, as twin pioneers of the new journalism of that time, we too, cradled in the same new sheets, made an epic in the criticism of the theater and the opera house by making it a pretext for a propaganda of our own views of life. So you cannot plead ignorance of the character of the force you set in motion. You meant me to épater le bourgeois, and if he protests, I hereby refer him to you as the accountable party."
Okay.
so and again, the letter goes on for many pages. You know, PT, when I picked up, you know, my copy of Man and Superman and decided, okay, well, let me just dig into the Act Three,
mm-hmm,
scene. This is the Don Juan play. But like you said, the characters from the other acts of the play take on basically Don Juan characters. So the main character in Man and Superman, right, Tanner, he becomes Don Juan.
Don Juan, right.
His charge, Anne Whitfield, who is in the other part of the play, is in love with Tanner's and is pursuing him.
Right? Well,
or
maybe.
Maybe, right, right. She becomes Dona Ana. Right.
Right.
Her father becomes a statue who is actually in heaven.
Yeah. In the play, he's not actually her father. He's her guardian. Her father has died.
That's right. That's right. It's
a code guardian with
Ramsden,
Tanner.
Roebuck Ramsden. Right. Who is co-guardian with Tanner. Yes. And then, of course, you mentioned the devil. And the interesting thing is that Anna, you know, comes to find that she's in hell with Don Juan and the devil, and so the antics begin.
Right. And let's go back to my grumbling before. One of the things that was kind of cultural in this era is women did not pursue.
Right.
Now, everything women did was what we might call passive-aggressive right. now in that era, and this was precisely one of Shaw's points. It might not be aggressive, but it is so effective.
Right. Some more modern day critics might have sometimes criticize Shaw because they say, oh, you know, here he is, you know, the only pursuit, you know, that he gives to women is marriage. But other feminist scholars have come back and said, no. If you take a look at Anne's character, she's going after what she wants.
She absolutely is. And if you look at some of the other plays, the women there are equally effective in getting what they want or keeping what they want or what have you. I don't want to go into it too much because we're already discussing Man and Superman, but in Candida, the woman in the play is presented with two people and demand that she make her choice. And she not only demolishes their pretensions, she gets what she wanted, which is to be pretty much the way she had been living before. And that is something that keeps on coming up in Shaw's plays. You have these men allegedly all advanced and with these wonderful philosophical ideas, and they come to a sticking point, usually over a woman, and the woman demolishes all of this fluff and bother that they've been coming up with for right. the previous acts.
Right. Well, in relation to Candida, you know, Shaw has basically said at one point, everyone around me was writing unconventional plays. I decided to write a conventional one. Yet, even in that thought and that sentence, he's playing with us, just like you were saying here, BT.
He absolutely
because
is.
He's turning conventions upside down. So in Candida, it is a domestic play of a love triangle. The Reverend James Morrell and his wife, Candida, and then this young poet, you know,
right.
Eugene Marchbanks. And of course, both the Reverend just, you know, thinks the world of his wife and says, you know, early on in the play, well, everybody loves her. And he loves that about her. And the two men are fighting for her attentions. And the interesting thing is all three of those characters, Shaw writes in a full way. They're not caricatured.
They aren't. Despite being in this situation, the Reverend is very much like Shaw in that people will give him a conventional observation and he will turn around and bat them on the head with it, coming up with something totally unconventional and making a good argument for it.
Right. And over the course of the play, I interviewed a woman who, an actor who played Candida many, many years ago in Arizona, and she basically told me, she said, look, nothing happens in this play. It's all internal, and I think she's right. There is a journey that happens in this play. It's the journey of the two men.
Absolutely.
Candida does not change. She knows who she is. She's the catalyst for their change. But in that sense, I think Candida is very much a modern woman, even if
the woman herself is not only modern, she's probably the most sensible person in the play. The poet
Eugene
says some perfectly nauseating things in this, in his adoration of Candida. Candida goes to put oil in the coal oil in the lamps, and he starts maundering about how she could put her perfect hands in the coal oil. And, you know, maybe there were lots of people around there who thought like that in Shaw's era, but you don't find it today. And people who read that or see that on the stage just go, ew.
Right. And Vijay, you were mentioning how Candida really is in control of the situation. Toward the end of the play, both men who are just, you know, enamored in love, they think they're in love with Candida, whether they are or not, that's, we could debate about that. And they finally come to her just exasperated and say, okay, you have to choose. You know,
These guys have worked themselves up into a perfect lather, and this is a key point, I think, without referencing her opinions at all, and they work themselves up in such a lather, they bring her in and say, okay, choose one of us, and she proceeds to destroy all the pretensions of the previous act.
Absolutely. So before, Candida has just walked in to the scene where Morel and Eugene Marchbanks are kind of arguing about this amongst themselves, and Morel says, I have nothing to tell her except that she is my greatest treasure on earth, if she is really mine. And I think just in that sentence, what Shaw is doing, number one, you can see that Morel maybe doesn't see his wife as a full, you know, fully. He doesn't have a full view of his wife. He does love her. He does treasure her, but she is his greatest treasure on earth. But then he does have a slight realization, if she is really mine.
Well, at this point, he has been goaded by the poet.
That's right.
Enough that he started to doubt that she might have some other opinion somewhere.
Right. Candida responds, I am sure Eugene can say no less, if that is all. And Eugene says, Morel, she's laughing at us. And indeed, she really
is. And she is.
And
deservedly so.
And later, you know, a few pages down in the play, basically, you know, the man, I think it comes from her husband, says, okay, you know, let us plead our case. And P.T., how does she respond to that? I'm trying to find the quote here.
Well, first she gets sarcastic. She says, oh, I'm up for bid now.
Right. So here, oh, I am to choose, am I?
Yes.
I suppose it is quite settled that I must belong to one or the other.
Yeah, aha. Right.
Here's Shaw really taking that institution of marriage apart.
Right.
And Morel, who's, you know, maybe not quite as far in his evolution as any of us would like to think, he says, quite, you must choose definitely. And Marchbanks, the Eugene Marchbanks, you know, says, Morel, you don't understand. She means that she belongs to herself.
Which is probably the final realization, and she goes on subsequently to prove it,
right?
Without doubt.
Her next line is, "I mean that, and a good deal more, Master Eugene, as you will both find out presently. And pray, my lords and masters, what have you to offer for my choice? I am up for auction, it seems. What do you bid?" Yes, and absolutely. So she really is in control.
She is, and I want to carry it just a bit further. She finally says, okay, I will choose the weaker man.
That's right.
And, of course, she chooses the parson, but he's the weaker man because he's always been cosseted and looked after and fawned over and couldn't possibly fend for himself, whereas Eugene, who is a poet and used to being unhappy, probably can.
Right. But Eugene even recognizes that he has grown because of her, even though, and here's one of the other criticisms from modern eyes, that Candida is not necessarily portrayed or painted as Eugene's intellectual equal in terms of maybe, I don't know, well-read or education.
But she doesn't have to be.
But she doesn't have to be. But it is through her that he realizes that, you know what, marriage and the love of a woman doesn't have to be the be-all and end-all. There's more to life than this. And Eugene, sometimes we use his first name and his last name. It's
right.
Hard to keep track of them. He realizes, you know, Candida has chosen James, and he realizes, aha, that is who she should choose because he shouldn't be here anymore. And he's about ready to depart, and Candida says, one last word. How old are you, Eugene? And he replies, as old as the world now. This morning I was 18.
Mm-hmm. And she teaches a lesson. Now, what's interesting to me in this context, Lee, is Shaw turns that idea on its head when he comes to Man and Superman.
Okay.
Because the hero there, Jack Tanner, is a completely confirmed bachelor for just those reasons. He realizes that there's much more to it than he wants to deal with, and yet he finds himself in a rather awkward romantic situation with Anne Whitefield.
Right, absolutely. And
I often wonder, when I wonder about these things, which probably isn't all that often, if Shaw didn't take the philosophy in Candida and turn it on its head entirely for Man and Superman.
Right. And then also expand on it in that act, in that
absolutely
act three.
Turn it into grand philosophy, although if you poke into it, I'm not sure it's that grand.
Well, and he expands the philosophy, so it's not just taking a look or an analytical look at the institution of marriage, but he takes a look at other institutions, and in particular, one of the most harrowing speeches comes from the devil talking about man's, and by that we mean humankind's, but this is in Shaw's phrasing, man's inventiveness. PG, I had to relook up this morning what year Man and Superman came about, right? And it was I believe it was first published in 1903.
Oh, 03, yeah, was the first play, I think, in 04. But
right,
yeah, all of that signifies that all this thinking that was going on happened before the First World War, which right. validated a good many of Shaw's opinions, or society after the war validated many of
right.
Shaw's opinions.
So in Man and Superman, just like in many of his other plays, but more pointedly here, he's taking apart the institution of marriage. He's taking apart the institution of religion. He has very little... how shall we say, good feelings about man's political nature. He called the political nature of human beings an utter failure. As political animals, we have utterly failed.
And yet, the point of Act Three is that there's this mysterious thing called the life force, which maybe the objection is that marriage is the wrong way to go about doing it. But he has this recognition that there is something there, and it's pretty important. Marriage might not be the best method, but the things that cause marriage are a part of what is real.
Right. And that life force, you know, he wants human beings to invest in their minds and in their knowledge. You know, he's not so much, okay, you don't have to have a superior body to have a... So he wants people to have superior minds.
Right.
And in Act 3 in Man and Superman, I have a couple of quotes. We have about 5 minutes left already,
okay.
PT. This is the devil talking to Don Juan and the others. And one of the things that the devil says is that all man's reason has done for him is to make him beastlier than any beast. And if you want to find out, well, what does Shaw mean by this? Here's something the devil says, and we're talking well over 100 years ago, before World War I, before World War II, before we've come to our present age. The devil says, and is man any the less destroying himself for all this boasted brain of his? Have you walked up and down upon the earth lately? I have, and I have examined man's wonderful inventions, and I tell you that in the arts of life, man invents nothing, but in the arts of death, he outdoes nature herself, and produces by chemistry and machinery all the slaughter of plague, pestilence, and famine. The present I tempt today I'm sorry, the peasant I tempt today eats and drinks what was eaten and drunk by the peasants of 10,000 years ago. And the house he lives in has not altered as much in 1,000 centuries as the fashion of a lady's bonnet in 100 weeks. But when he goes out to slay, he carries a marvel of mechanism that lets loose at the touch of his finger all the hidden molecular energies and leaves the javelin, the arrow, the blowpipe of his fathers far behind. In the arts of peace, man is a bungler. I have seen his cotton factories and the like, with machinery that a greedy dog could have invented if it had wanted money instead of food. I know his clumsy typewriters and bungling locomotives and tedious bicycles. They are toys compared to the Maxim gun, the submarine torpedo boat. There is nothing in man's industrial machinery but his greed and sloth. His heart is in his weapons. This could be a lecture that he could give today, and we still might need to stand up and listen.
There are points to be made there, and especially since weaponry has proliferated to the point where people can just go out in the street and shoot lots of other people.
Right.
And yet, when it comes down to the absolute morality, what it turns out, or what the devil says anyway, is the difference between heaven and hell is attitude.
Right.
You want to come and live in hell? Fine. You want to go live in heaven? Fine. Go to the door, go up one flight, and there you go. There's no real difference. It's only your attitude toward it. And that it not only upsets every religious aspect, but it also is something to think about in how you live.
Right, absolutely. That Shaw is really saying that this responsibility is in our hands.
Right.
And if we would focus on developing our life force, maybe not following some of his old ideas about how you do that, we'll set those aside for a second, but if we would invest in developing our superior minds and this life force and this idea of equality and nonviolence and putting, you know, more money into preventing that poverty that he saw walking across London that one night than we do in our weaponry.
And what's also interesting, if I remember it correctly, is also he said that, you know, if you want to go visit the other place, sure, take some time off.
Absolutely. And the devil and Don Juan, you know, are basically saying, hey, look, you know, down here in hell, it's much more fun. And the statue who's been up in heaven all this time, he wants to come down to hell because, you know, it's more interesting.
Yeah.
There are more things to do.
Whatever appeals to you at any given time, sure, go ahead. Shaw was clear that the heaven that he envisioned was the one that he would choose. The intellectual was there, the serious was there,
right.
The consequential was there, but then there's always hell.
That's right. Well, you know, PT, we are about 45 seconds away from the top of the hour where you can tune in and catch Tim Hogenboom and his show
Can't
Not
Miss
Fade
that.
Away. I know. I listen to it as we leave the studio every week. So, PT, we might have to come back and do another episode on Shaw so we can wrap up.
That will give us more time to do some of his other plays. I think many people know Shaw only through his play Pygmalion, which got turned into My Fair Lady, much different in philosophy.
That's right. Well, come back and be with us next week. We really want to thank you today for listening to Literature. Good day and good reading. The viewpoints expressed in the preceding program were not necessarily those of WRUU, its license holder, or its staff. This is WRUULP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.